the devotees, especially of His Grace Eklavya Prabhu. We did not know that He was here, okay, so that I can try to glorify the Bhagavad Gita on this sacred day. So, we'll try to discuss today how the Bhagavad Gita is special at different levels. Firstly, how the Bhagavad Gita is special among the world literature, how it is special among the world's religious literature, how it is special among the Vedic literature, how it is special among the Vaishnava literature, and how it is special among the Gaudiya Vaishnava literature. So let's see how much we can complete in the allocated time, but we'll try that. So, as the Bhagavatam describes in the first canto, that Nayad vachas chitrapadam harer yasho jagat pavitram pragranit karichit tadvayasam tirtham ushanti manasha yatra hamsa niramanti ushikshaya. It says that those words, no matter how poetically, artistically they may be written, if they do not glorify the Lord, they are like a pilgrimage place for the cows. That is a very euphemistic, a polite way of saying that it is a garbage dump. Because what is a pilgrimage place for cows? For crows, rather, sorry. For crows, it is actually a garbage dump. So, now this is the Bhagavatam's perspective, but even from the objective perspective, among the hundreds and thousands of books that are written, most of the books, they are written and they are read once, if at all they are read, and they are thrown away. And nobody really cares. Among the books that are written, the most popular are the newspapers, what is published. Newspapers are not books, but what is newspapers and novels. And neither of them really have a very great longevity. And not only that, most of them actually do not convey anything meaningful, even from the material point of view. All that they offer is something temporarily titillating, some entertainment, some information at all. So, even from the material point of view, the Bhagavad Gita is among the world's top three books which have been translated in the maximum number of languages. One is the Christian Bible, the other is the Chinese Tao Te Ching, and the third is the Bhagavad Gita. Of course, nobody has done any strict survey, so it might be the Bhagavad Gita has been translated into many more languages. Because India itself has so many languages and so many dialects. It has been translated a lot. So, it's a very well-known book. And of course, Bhagavad Gita has the undisputed record of being the book which has the maximum commentaries on it. Even the Bible has not so many commentaries on it. So, because India had a huge, enormous tradition of intellect, of scholarship. And India, traditional India, scholarship means scholarship based on scripture. There was only after the heterodox religions like Buddhism and Jainism came that something other than Vedic literature became the basis of scholarship. And even that scholarship was to refute the Vedic literature. So in that sense also it was not independent of Vedic literature. But, so most of the literature are just for entertainment and they have very short term value. But we see that the Bhagavad Gita conveys something meaningful. It has enduring value, been existing for thousands of years, and still it's widely appealing. So there are, of course, there are nowadays becoming popular is called self-help books. Self-help means if you are depressed, if you are feeling inferiority complex, if you are sorry for yourself, whatever, then then you read these books and you will feel better. Now, most I used to read a lot of self-help books before I at least externally came to Krishna consciousness. But, you know, they talk about self-help, but they don't know who is the self. So how can they actually help? So they don't contain any philosophy, practically speaking. It just feel good, be good, that sort of things. So these are books are widespread and they are practical, but there is no philosophy in them. And there are books written by philosophers and they may contain some meaningful philosophy, but one of the tragedies of Western philosophy is that it has become completely divorced from practice. The philosophers cannot, even if at all they postulate some philosophy, they do not tell anything by which, if their philosophy is real, how it can be realized. So there is a vacuum. There are books which are practical with no philosophy. There are books which are philosophical with nothing practical. But Bhagavad Gita is such a book, it is profoundly philosophical, at the same time powerfully practical. So, it reveals the highest truth, Tattvam Param Guhyam, as it is said over here. At the same time, what it recommends at the end to do is very practical. Think of Krishna, worship him, chant his holy names, offer homage to him. So, in that sense, it's very practical. So, it's unique in that sense also. Now, among the religious literatures in the world, most of the other literatures of the world, like the Bible or the Quran, you know, they are books of commandments. Do this, do that. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not this. Thou shalt not that. The Bhagavad Gita is special in that it is not so much a book of commandments as a book of choices. As a book of choices. That means, yes, the Bhagavad Gita does contain some commands, as Krishna says, Sarva Dharman Parityajya. But that is in the conclusion. Vishwanathachakra Thakur explains that the Vedic statements in the imperative are instructions. That means, now Dehi no smin yatha dehe. This verse does not contain anything what you should do. So it's certainly a Vedic statement, but it's not an instruction. It's a Vedic statement. Those which are in the imperative, like Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mam Ekam Charanam. These sort of instructions or Sarva Karmani Manasa Sanyasya Adhyatma Chetasa. These sort of verses, they contain a call for action. And they are in the imperative. So those are instructions which cannot be avoided. But if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, more than the instructions that Bhagavad Gita gives choices. Wherever in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks, if you look at the fourth chapter, he says, if you are faithful, what will happen? If you are faithless, what will happen? He says, Shraddhava labhate jnanam tatpara sanyatendriyah jnanam labdhva param shantim achirena digachyati. So he says that if you are faithful, then you will acquire knowledge. And if you acquire knowledge, then soon you will become that acquire unadulterated peace. And on the other hand, he says, Agnyascha shraddhadhanascha samshayatma vinashyati nayam lokosti naparo nasukham samshayatmanaha. And if you are faithless, if you are doubtful, then what will happen? You will neither be happy in this life nor in that life. So, towards the conclusion of the Bhagavad Gita, also Krishna says, that machitta sarva durgani mat prasada tarishyasi athachetvam ahankaran nashroshyasi vinangshyasi. It's very clearly indicative of Krishna consciousness. If you become conscious of me, you will pass over all obstacles by my grace. If however you act out of false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. So Krishna gives choices and Krishna tells us the consequences of the choices. And at the end he says, Vimrishyaita dasheshena yathechasi tathakuru. Now Arjuna, deliberate on this and decide what you want to do. So Krishna is not the kind of God who imposes his will on the living entity. Of course he does not do it practically, and even in his instructions, he doesn't do that. He gives us the choices and he gives the consequences. And he leaves it up to the individual what he wants to do. That's why the approach of the Bhagavad Gita is intellectually much more appealing. It's much more reasonable. And not only that, among all the world's scriptures, the Bhagavad Gita has the most fascinating setting. It has the most fascinating setting. Actually, the Bible was never written. The Bible as a book was never spoken. No, Jesus never said, now I am going to start speaking the Bible. It was never like that. Jesus spoke on different occasions, different things. And those of his disciples who were there at that time, many of them didn't even realize that he is the Son of God and what he is speaking is very significant. So, later on, after he was crucified and after they experienced what they call as the Holy Ghost, then they started feeling, oh, Jesus was a special person. And then they started compiling his words into written form. And actually, the historians of religion have analyzed that there was a big scandal about whose books will be included in the Bible. because there were so many prophets, and there were even who will be included as the 12 apostles, there was politics involved in that also. So actually, first of all, Jesus is not God, with all due respects to him. And even what we have in the Bible is not his words. He spoke a lot, and what people recollected, and who was close to him, and who was far from him, like Paul, who was considered one of the apostles, he never met Jesus. And today in the Bible, his section is the maximum. This is not to discredit the Bible, but the point is that the Bible is not a direct word of God. It is a word of the Son of God, and that also remembered and recollected selectively. So, in that sense, and the Bible itself, that's why the Bible itself does not have a setting. Because, of course, in one sense we can say it was in Nazareth and the other places where Jesus lived, but there was no specific setting for the speech of the Bible. Similarly, for the Quran, if we see, the Quran was not spoken by God. It was actually spoken by a representative of God, an angel called Gabriel, and it was heard by Muhammad. So Muhammad went on top of a mountain, and suddenly he heard a voice. He says, write. So Muhammad was illiterate. He said, I don't know how to write. He says, write. He says, I don't know how to write. He says, write. And he didn't know what to do. He just took a plate and started moving his fingers. And the Quran started getting written over there. And then afterwards, later on, of course, that was not the Quran. Later on, what the Quran came out was again a compilation from different places. The Bible, as we know, was written several centuries after Jesus passed away from the world also. The Quran is slightly more authentic in that sense. But even the Bible and the Quran have several versions. So, it is the word of God coming through some medium. And that's why the setting is, okay, it was on top of a mountain and he had a revelation and he got the words. But if you see the Bhagavad Gita, it's on the place where one would think it's most unlikely to discuss philosophy. It's right in the middle of a battlefield. And not that the battle is not started or the battle is over and it's an isolated battlefield and you're sitting and talking. No. It's a battlefield where the action is about to take place. And the whole narrative of the Mahabharata is reaching its climax in the battlefield. In fact, actually, in one sense, there are some events which are determined. You know, like say, whether it makes a prediction that this is going to, that it's going to rain over here. Or say on so and so, this particular cricket match is there, or this and so particular yatra is there, or whatever. That's a determined event. So, the way Vyasadeva and our Vedic sages have arranged the Mahabharata, throughout the Mahabharata, the final battle is the most overdetermined event. That means everyone knows that it's going to happen. No matter what all peace efforts Krishna tries, others try, they know if the battle is going to take place. And so the whole Mahabharata, in one sense, it spans a huge number of verses. It's 110,000 verses. It's the world's longest poem by far. The other two longest poems, Iliad and Odyssey, both of them seven times combined together are less than the Mahabharata. So the Mahabharata is huge. But in that, as the climax of the Mahabharata is coming, the climax is the battle. And as the battle is about to start, as the even the conches are blown. Conches are blown means the battle is about to start. It's like, you know, the conch is blown and everybody has come for darshan, the aarti is about to start, and suddenly the pujari stops doing the aarti. And everybody is wondering, what is happening? That's what happened. There is perplexity on the battlefield. So, that's how it was a very, very intriguing setting that was created. Right in the battlefield, in front of the enemy, Arjuna gets a nervous breakdown. He gets overwhelmed. He says, how can I fight? So, at any other time, if philosophy is spoken, it's not as significant. People may or may not be interested. But here, when a war is about to take place, all the ears are there, all the eyes are there. It's complete attention. And the philosophy is heard very attentively. So, actually, in one sense, we'll come to this a little later in the when you talk about the Vedic literature. But the point is that just as in the Vedic literature, the Shrutis are considered to be the highest, and the Itihasas are considered to be a little lower, and the Bhagavad Gita is among the Itihasas. But if you see, the Gita's position in the Vedic literature is similar to Krishna's position in the Mahabharata. Throughout the Mahabharata, actually, Krishna plays a low profile. In the Mahabharata, the Pandavas are the heroes. Much of the story is centered around the Pandavas. But when the time, when the most overdetermined event, when the climax of the Mahabharata comes up, it is at that time Krishna plays a decisive role. So, similarly, among the Vedic literature, the Bhagavad Gita may appear to be in the Itihasas. But in sum total, actually from the importance, from the relevance, from the practicality point of view, the Bhagavad Gita steals the show. As Krishna actually stole the show in the Battle of Kurukshetra. So we'll discuss this a little bit more later. But the point is, the setting is very intriguing. And in fact, all over the world, people of different religions, they try to popularize their religious teachings. So the Christians may make some movies on life of Jesus. The Muslims make some movies on the life of Muhammad. Of course, they are not allowed to show the face of Muhammad. So they have to make a movie without showing the face of Muhammad, which is a difficult task. That is their idea, that just as God is impersonal, so his selected representative also, although he was a historical person, you are not allowed to show him as a person. It's a little strange idea. So, but, and so we may also have movies about Krishna. But how can anyone make a movie about a Bible? Or about a Quran. So interestingly, there was one popular novelist, he is still there, is Stephen Pressfield. So he decided, he read the Bhagavad Gita and is very inspired by the Bhagavad Gita. And he decided that he will popularize the message of the Bhagavad Gita in the West. So he wrote a novel about a golf match. And in golf match, he called it The Legend of Bagger Vance. So Bagger Vance is the assistant of a golf player. The golf player is Ranulf Junna. So, and he gets depressed before a championship golf match. And his assistant turns into his advisor. So, this Ranulf Junna, the short form is R. Junna. That is Arjuna. And Bagger Vance is actually a westernized rendition of Bhagavan, Bhagavan. So he does it in a very interesting way. So he says, so Arjuna, you are depressed about hitting the swing. You have to swing the whatever, the stick or whatever, to hit the ball in the golf. So who is it that is going to hit the swing? Is it your arms? Is it your body? Is it your father? Is it your wife? Is it your ancestors? Who are you? So, that's how he presents the message of the Bhagavad Gita. And then he first wrote a novel which became so popular that it was later on made into a movie. And then our devotees are very opportunistic for preaching. So we have our devotee writer, Satyaraj Prabhu. So he went and met this Stephen Pressfield. Now Stephen Pressfield was very happy that there's a real Gita scholar who has come to meet him, and incidentally Satyaraj Prabhu's first name was also Stephen Rosen. So Stephen. So he liked that also, Stephen. And then what Satyaraj Prabhu did is, he took the same novel and expanded it and added the Bhagavad Gita philosophy more systematically and more coherently. And he wrote a book, Gita on the Press, the mystical tradition behind Bagger Vance. And that book also became very popular. So, actually, the setting of the Gita is very special. And that grabs the mind and draws the attention of people towards philosophy. So, that's among the world's literature. The setting is very special. It's a book of choices, not commandments. And again, among the different religious books, the Bhagavad Gita is the most philosophical. If you look at the Bible and the Quran, as I said, they are mostly commandments. Do this, don't do this. But there's not much philosophy. There is nothing like we have the three modes of material nature in the Bhagavad Gita. There's nothing like who is the real I? Who is the real I? Actually, Jesus spoke the Bible 2000 years ago, and till now the Christians are confused of what Jesus meant when he said the soul. They have no, when they use the word soul, their understanding is not the same as the soul as we have. Now they have the idea that the humans have souls, but animals don't have souls. So then how are animals conscious? They say animals have spirit, but not soul. So what is the spirit? So they don't know what is the spirit, and they don't know what is the soul. That's why, to make things clear, Prabhupada said spirit soul. So there's nothing very clear about who the real person is, and why he's suffering in the material world, and how he's supposed to get out. So the philosophy is very clearly given in the Bhagavad Gita. Now, among the, so that was in the religious literature of the world. Now, among the Vedic literature. Now, the Vedic literature are bewilderingly vast. You know, there are 1 lakh verses. That's what is existing now. It might have been much more earlier. So they are so huge. And they even appear to be mutually contradictory. Because the Vedas, if we see, they are themselves, in one sense, quite materialistic. Materialistic in the sense they talk about material well-being that can be got through religion. They talk, you do this particular yagya and you get this particular result. You do this particular puja and you get this particular result. It's karma kanda. And then, the Upanishads are practically speaking entirely opposite of the Vedas. The Upanishads just completely reject all sorts of material well-being, and they say all sorts of material pleasures and pains are illusory and one has to transcend it all. So, when the Western scholars came to India, they were bewildered how such drastically different approaches could be there within one religion. Now, one is talking about material well-being, the other is talking completely about material renunciation. Another aspect is, the Vedas are more religious, whereas the Upanishads are more philosophical. That means the Vedas talk a lot about rituals, do this, do this, do that, but they don't talk much about the truths of life. The Upanishads, on the other hand, they talk a lot of philosophy, but they don't contain anything practical, what to do. It's just analysis, contemplation, speculation, that sort of thing. So it was in this context that Krishna spoke. The Bhagavad Gita plays a very, Krishna's Bhagavad Gita plays a very significant role. So, actually, what happens is the Vedic literature, the message of the Vedic literature can be compared to be a, like we compare it to the, normally a yogic ladder. So, it's not just a ladder actually, it's like a building. Because on a ladder, people don't stay. But actually, on each level, people stay. You know, there are karmakandis who stay on that level for lifetimes. And there are jnanis who stay on their level for lifetimes. So more appropriate analogy is stories. Now, there are different stories on this building. So the ground floor is the floor of karmakanda. So that is talked about in the Vedic literature. And the first floor is about the negation of everything material. And the second floor is about the attaching oneself to something positive. So what happens is, the Vedas talk about the ground floor. The Upanishads talk about the first floor. But there doesn't seem to be much of a connect, any literature that connects the Vedas to the Upanishads. So what the Bhagavad Gita does is, the setting of the Bhagavad Gita, many people consider the Mahabharata to be like a karmakanda literature. Because it talks so much about material affairs, politics and conspiracy and romance and violence and war and all those things. So, there, when Arjuna is talking, Arjuna, in the first chapter when he talks, all his calculations are primarily materialistic. So if I fight, and even if I win, I will have no one to enjoy my life with. And if I don't fight, then I will lose the kingdom. So these calculations are actually quite materialistic in that sense. So what Arjuna, what Krishna does is, Krishna does not address his questions directly. He says, either I have to kill my relatives or I have to be killed. So what Krishna does is, so Arjuna is talking on the ground floor. But the first thing that Krishna does is takes him to the first floor. What he says is, actually, what are you talking about being killed? You are not going to be killed, they are not going to be killed. So, many times there are atheistic philosophers or philosophers. So, they try to point out logically impossible situations based on which they try to prove how God cannot be existent or God cannot be omnipotent. So, one of their favorite questions is, one devotee sent me this question by mail, so I was replying to him. So he said, can God commit suicide? Because this is a question, you know, if you say yes, then that means God will no longer be existing. Then God will not be eternal. And if you say no, then that means there is something which God cannot do. Therefore, God is not omnipotent. So these sort of questions, you know, have to be answered by challenging the assumptions which are behind the questions. Just like if somebody comes and asks a man, have you stopped beating your wife? Now if he says, no, shameless guy, you're beating your wife. And if you say yes, that means you admit you're beating your wife in the past. So these questions are designed to trap. These are called as catch-22 questions or loaded questions. So, you know, although the questions demand a yes-no answer, but the answer has to be given not in terms of yes-no, but by challenging the assumption behind the question. Who told you that I beat my wife? Isn't it? So like that, first of all, the question, can God commit suicide? That just indicates that God becomes frustrated like we become frustrated. Isn't it? That's the assumption. Just think, you know, this person is so frustrated. He's thinking of committing suicide and he's projecting his suicidal tendencies on God. So God is Anandmayo Abhyasat. He is always joyful. And so because he is never frustrated like we are frustrated, so there is no question of suicide for him. So there are people who try to pose logically impossible situations. So Krishna challenges such people in 9.4 and 9.5. He says, Mayatatamidam sarvam jagadavyakta murtina matsthani sarvabhutani nachaham teshvavasthitaha. So he says, by me in my unmanifested form, this whole world is pervaded. This whole universe is pervaded. Matsthani sarvabhutani. All living beings rest in me. Nachaham teshvavasthitaha. But I am not in them. And then after saying this, so this itself is bewildering enough. You know, okay, I am everywhere, everything rests in me. If I am everywhere, then how does everything rest in me? Because I am everywhere. Okay, but somehow it may be there. It's God. But then, he says, Bhutani na chaham teshu avasthita. But I am everywhere, but I am not everywhere. That's the first contradiction. I am not everywhere. And then he's saying, next thing, to make it even worse, he just, matsthani sarva bhutani, he contradicts by saying, na cha matsthani bhutani. The next 9.5 is, Nacha matsthani bhutani pashyame yogamaishwaram bhuta bhranna cha bhutasto mamatma bhuta bhavana. That I am not present everywhere. So now this verse, for the logicians, it's completely bewildering. And the only way out of the bewilderment, they say that Krishna is confused. But actually, they don't understand. Krishna's words are so deep. Actually, this verse, Mayatatamidam Sarvam Jagadavyakta Murtina, this is one verse which concentrates the entire absolute truth in it. So, Mayatatamidam Sarvam Jagadavyakta Vartina refers to the Brahman aspect, the Brahma Jyoti. Matsthani Sarvabhutani refers to the Paramatma aspect. And Nachaham Teshu Avasthita refers to the Bhagavan aspect. So, Mayatatamidam Sarvam Jagadavyakta Murtina. By me, the whole universe is pervaded in my unmanifested form. That is the Brahma Jyoti. Is there everywhere. यस्य प्रभा प्रभवतो जगदंड कोटि कोटीश्वशेष वसुतादि विभूति भिन्नम तद्ब्रह्म निष्कलम अनंतम शेष भूतम गोविंदमादि पुरुषम तमहं भजामि. सो जनरली प्रभुपाद कोट्स दिस वर्स टू टॉक अबाउट हाउ द यूनिवर्सेस आर एक्सटेंडिंग इन द ब्रह्म ज्योति, बट आल्सो टॉक्स अबाउट तद्ब्रह्म निष्कलम अशेष अनंत. सो इट्स अशेष, देयर इज नथिंग अपार्ट रिमेनिंग एक्सेप्ट दैट, एंड अनंत इज अनलिमिटेड. सो the first two lines of 9.4 refer to Brahman. Then matsthani sarvabhutani, all living beings are sustained by me, all living beings exist in me. This refers to the paramatma aspect. Gama vishya bhutani dharayami hamojasa. Krishna says that I enter into all the worlds. Here he's talking specifically about the earth, but other places he talks about how he enters into all the universe and he pervades them and he sustains them. So matsthani sarvabhutani refers to the paramatma. And then he says nacha aham teshu avasthita, but I am not situated in them. That refers to Bhagavan. This material world is sustained by Krishna, but that is by his paramatma expansion. So he is not present there. And that is elaborated further in the next verse when Krishna said nacha matsthani bhutani, that I am not sustaining the three worlds. What is that referring to? It is referring to the Bhagavan. The Bhagavan aspect is not sustaining the three worlds. It is the Paramatma aspect who is sustaining the three worlds. Machamatthani bhutani pashyame yoga maishwaram. Just see my inconceivable potency. So in this way, Krishna actually addresses many difficult to resolve philosophical questions, theological questions, by the profound philosophy that is given in the Bhagavad Gita. So this three-tier understanding of God, Brahma Jyoti, Paramatma, Bhagavan, this is not there in any other religious literature. What to speak of that? It is not there clearly even in the Upanishadic literature. It is not there even in the Vedanta Sutra. And if you look at it, this three-tier revelation is actually the contribution of the Gaudiya Vaishnavism to world literature. Because if you see the Bhagavatam verse 1.2.11, from which we explain this, Vadanti Tattvavidas, Tattvam Yad Gyanam Amvayam, Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavaneti Shabdyate. It just talks about Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. But it doesn't actually tell what is Brahman, what is Paramatma, what is Bhagavan. And it doesn't talk about these three as a three-tier reality. All that it says is Advaim, all three are non-dual. So there are places where Brahman refers to Bhagavan also, and Paramatma also may refer to Brahman or Bhagavan, whatever. So it is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, this is the same Krishna who spoke the Bhagavad Gita, who inspired Shukdev Goswami to speak Bhagavatam. That same Krishna through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu revealed the clearest understanding of the absolute truth. So now when we understand Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy and then we look at the Bhagavad Gita, then the Bhagavad Gita makes complete sense. Then actually the Bhagavad Gita is fully understood. So among the Vedic literature, what is the Bhagavad Gita actually doing? The Bhagavad Gita is actually integrating all the Vedic wisdom that is available into one book and establishing which is the highest. Establishing what path is the highest. So, if we see in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks, there are basically three divisions. There is karma, there is jnana, and there is bhakti. Yoga is basically Ashtanga yoga is basically a combination of karma and jnana. The first is one does karma and later on one does contemplation. So, in one sense, if we say, this is universal in all religions or all spiritual seekers. Some people try to do a lot of activities and try to realize God. Some people try to do a lot of thinking and they try to realize God. So, karma and jnana in that sense are actually universal in all religions. So karma kand is the Vedas, the jnana kand is the Upanishads. So now if we see, the human mind universally has two tendencies. There is sankalpa and vikalpa. Sankalpa means to accept. And vikalpa means to reject. So these human tendencies are represented in the Vedic literature where the karma kand section represents the human tendency towards sankalpa. Accepting the material world for one's enjoyment. And the jnana kand section represents the human tendency towards vikalpa, towards giving it up, renouncing it. Like Prabhupada talks in the Nectar of Devotional Introduction, bhoga and tyaga. So, but the Bhagavad Gita talks about both these things, but it actually in the first chapter itself, when Arjuna is asking this question, he is basically talking on the karmakanda level. He's talking, oh, I'll go to hell if I kill my relatives and all that. And in the second chapter itself, Krishna rejects the karmakanda level by saying, Traigunya Vishaya Veda Nistraigunya Bhava Arjuna. But he addresses that level and he shows how the problems at the material level cannot be solved at the material level. So Albert Einstein is considered to be very famous because, you know, he was completely bewildered because he proposed his relativity theory and Niels Bohr proposed his quantum theory. And both of them were completely complicated. So neither of them could solve it. So both of them, they were friends in the beginning of their life. When they died, they were enemies. So they couldn't talk with each other. But then, so he said, he tried his best to solve this problem. So toward the end of his life, he said that problems cannot be solved at the same level of consciousness that created them. So he was actually speaking a principle that Krishna implemented long ago in the Bhagavad Gita. So material problems cannot be solved at the material level. That's why Krishna takes things one level higher. And what does he? He talks about the Jnana Kanda. And essentially, if we see the whole Bhagavad Gita at the start of the third chapter, at the start of the fifth chapter, what is the option? Should I work or should I renounce work? That's, so should I work is actually the ground first floor. Should I renounce the second floor? And Krishna, although he tells him to work, he tells him to work in devotion, which actually takes him to third floor. So actually, what Krishna does is, he addresses the existing schools of thought and he establishes how bhakti is the greatest. So sometimes people ask, like my devotee was recently asking me, and it was a nice question. He said, we are doing the Bhakti Shastri course. So he said, when I heard the Krishna conscious philosophy, it was so simple. When I heard the Bhagavad Gita verses that support the Krishna conscious philosophy, it's so simple. But now when I start studying the Bhagavad Gita, it appears so complicated. So how is that? So actually, in one sense, the Krishna conscious philosophy and the Bhagavad Gita philosophy are two different things. How are they different? In the sense that the Bhagavad Gita does an overview of all Vedic philosophy, and the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita is Krishna conscious philosophy. So what happens is, when we hear just the conclusion and we hear some verses talking about the conclusion, Patram Pushpam Palam Doyam Sarva Dharman Parityajya Yagyarthat Karmano Anyatra Bahunam Janmanamante. Now there are some standard verses from the Bhagavad Gita which we all quote, and practically every ISKCON devotee knows those verses. So if that is all that Bhagavad Gita is, then it's very easy. But if you actually go into Bhagavad Gita, then we have to start understanding what is Karma Yoga, what is Jnana Yoga, what is Sankhya, what is Ishkam Karma, and then it becomes quite complicated. So actually the conclusion is very simple, and Prabhupada has mercifully given the conclusion. We'll come to that a little later. But the point is, you know, so why does Krishna not just tell us that bhakti is supreme, just do bhakti? Why does he actually have to tell all the paths? There are several reasons for that. One is the circumstantial reason. Now Arjuna was asking whether I should fight or I should not fight. So whether I should act or should not act. So Arjuna, Krishna has to give the reasoning, what is the logical consequence of acting in a fruitive way, what is the logical consequence of renouncing, and then he shows better than these two is the third option. So actually, in Western philosophy, they have something which is called thesis, antithesis, and they have synthesis. So, like a thesis means, you know, one party proposes an argument, and the other party comes and proposes his own argument, and both are completely opposed to each other. And then their debate will be endless. So third person comes, and he takes the right from this part, he takes the right from this part, and he brings a synthesis. Best of all, that's called synthesis. So like that, in the Bhagavad Gita, karma is a thesis. We should act, it's natural. But then the problem is, it's binding. And the antithesis is Jnana. God's Jnana say, actually, you should renounce work, then you will never come under bondage. But the problem is, it's impossible to do. You cannot be inactive. So the thesis and the antithesis. And that's what the Vedic literature, the conflict is going on. But Krishna comes and says, okay, acting is natural, so do that. But bondage is a problem, so throw it away. How do you do that? By working for me. So Krishna integrates the good part of both and introduces a higher paradigm of devotion to himself and actually gives a solution to the problem that is the tension throughout the Vedic literature. So that is Krishna's genius. So why Krishna talks about all these paths? to conclusively establish how Bhagavad Gita is the supreme, and how, sorry, Bhakti is the supreme in the Bhagavad Gita and in the Vedic literature also. So it's like, suppose a particular newspaper wanted to do its advertisement. So if it says, say, Times of India, 2.5 crore circulation every day. So, okay, we might read it and we'll go. Okay. That's not as effective if they do the advertisement. If they say, okay, Economic Times, 1 lakh. Hindustan Times, 25 lakhs. Daily Telegraph, 50 lakhs. Indian Express, 1 crore. Times of India, 2.5 crores. So what happens? Glorification by comparison is always much more powerful. It's always much more effective. So what Krishna does is, he glorifies bhakti by comparing other paths. And then he shows very clearly how bhakti is supreme. When Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita, so this is within the Vedic literature, Krishna actually gives the conclusion of the Vedic literature very easily and very clearly. And again, another thing, earlier I said that the Vedas are religious, whereas the Upanishads are philosophical. And the Bhagavad Gita is a philosophy that culminates in religion. It talks about philosophy, but it culminates in how you practice that philosophy, the path of devotion. So in that sense, it also integrates that. Now, more importantly, so that was from the Vedic point of view. Now, from the Vaishnava point of view, you know, the Bhagavad Gita is the only book in which God declares himself to be God. There is no other book in which a deity declares himself to be supreme throughout the book. Now, there are some literature, say like the Shiva Puran may say at some places that Shiva is supreme. And then the Devi Bhagavat may say that Devi is supreme. But then there are also, if one reads these verses, these books carefully, there are verses which qualify this. But there is no book like this where a particular deity is glorifying himself as God throughout the book. So when faced with this particular situation, you know, either the human mind will think that Krishna is a really egomaniac. I am God throughout the Bhagavad Gita. Or he's a liar, or he's really God. So now obviously, all the great acharyas have accepted Krishna's words. So he's not a liar. Is Krishna egomaniac in speaking about himself? So Vishwamitra Thakur gives a brilliant understanding for this. He says that actually the only purpose that Krishna speaks the Bhagavad Gita is to glorify Radharani.
How Radharani? No, Radharani is not there in the Bhagavad Gita only in one sense. Only one fourth of one verse is there, Daivim Prakriti Mashrita. You know, that our Vaishnavacharya has explained, it refers to Radharani. And if you look at Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, the name of Radharani comes only once in the Bhagavad Gita. The entire Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita is so exhaustive commentary. Only once the name of Radharani comes. And that is where, in the introduction, Prabhupada is offering obeisance to Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radharani. So then, how can Vishwa Chakravarti sustain his claim that actually Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks Bhagavad Gita to glorify Radharani? So actually, Radharani is the personification of devotional service. Radhini Shakti Asmat. So she is Radhini Shakti. She is the Bhakti. And Krishna's purpose in glorifying himself is only one. To convincingly convey the glory of the bhakti that conquers even him. That if you tell, you know, this person is a world emperor. He has defeated this country, king and this country. He has defeated this king and this country. He defeated this king and this country. You tell how he's a world conqueror. And then after that, you say there is some small villager in some city, in some village, and he has defeated this person in battle. Now, we may not think this person, villager, to be something very special. And even if he defeats somebody else, what's so great about it? But if you know the person who has defeated is a world emperor, a world conqueror, then you'll think, oh, this person must be great. So like that, bhakti used to be a very simple activity. You know, you just fold your hands and pray, or shake your hands and shake your head and chant, and offer obeisances and move some incense and aarti plates and whatever. It appears such a simple activity. But Krishna is telling us that this bhakti conquers me. And Vishwanatha Thakur said that the only purpose that Krishna speaks is his glories. If you see that way, where all does Krishna speak his glories? The 7th chapter, 9th chapter, 10th chapter, 11th chapter. Now, if you see in all these chapters, we don't have time to do that analysis now, but in all these chapters, soon after his own glorification, Krishna talks about how by my bhakta I am known, how to my bhakta I am sold out, how to my bhakta I cannot ever forget him, I cannot ever renounce him. He is more dear to me than myself. Ishto sime drudamiti tato vakshamite hitam. Just before speaking manmanabhava and sarvadharman prityajya, Krishna says, ishto sime drudamiti. You are dearly loved by me. So Garuda Prabhu, one of Prabhupada's disciples, he has translated this Bhagavad Gita as, Bhagavat as the beloved Lord, and Gita as the sacred love song, the secret love song. Because secret, so the beloved Lord's secret love song. So he translates this ishto sime drudamiti as, I am determined to love you. Krishna is saying, you are determined to forget me, but I am determined to love you. So Krishna's determination, so Bhagavad Gita, it's a profound philosophy, but ultimately it's a message of love. And that's why one of Srila Prabhupada's disciples, Yogeshwar Prabhu, wrote a Bhagavad Gita. So he says, very beautifully, the Bhagavad Gita is the most eloquent testimony to the transformative power of love. So testimony to what? To the transformative power of love. So all of us want to be transformed in our lives. We want to become better human beings, better persons, better devotees. How do we become better devotees? When we understand Krishna's love for us. And when we understand Krishna is so great, and he is extending his hand to us, that I want to love you. Why don't you love me? So then we are ready to renounce everything else. And Maam Ekam Sharanam Raja. That is the ultimate secret of the Bhagavad Gita. So Ramanujacharya, in his Bhagavad Gita introduction, offers a prayer to Bhagavad Gita, along with that offer to Krishna who speaks the Bhagavad Gita. So we'll offer that prayer and we'll conclude this class. So Prapanna Parijataya Totra Vetraika Panaye Vetraika Panaye Jnana Mudraya Krishnaya Mudraya Krishnaya Gitamrita Duhe Namaha. So he is integrating three different images of Krishna. Krishna is the God of the devotees. Prapanna Parijataya. One who surrenders to him, he protects him. But then, actually in his original form, he is not a God who surrenders, who accepts the surrender and the worship of his devotees. Who is he? Totra Vetraika Panaye. He's actually carrying a stick and he's herding the cows. And there's another aspect of God as Bhagavan in the spiritual world. And then he says, Krishna is also the God of the philosophers. Jnana Mudraya Krishnaya. That means he's giving actually knowledge. So when Krishna, we have this picture in the Bhagavad Gita, different pictures we have. One is Krishna wielding the chariot. Brother is Arjuna is that is folding his hands, and Krishna is raising his hand to give knowledge. Jnana Mudraya Krishnaya. So Gita Amruta Duhe Namaha. So that Lord Krishna who has given us the nectar of the Gita, to him I offer my obeisances. So it was Srila Prabhupada who actually brought to the world the secret of the Bhagavad Gita. Not only the Bhagavad Gita was unknown, but to whoever the Bhagavad Gita was known, the message of the Bhagavad Gita was unknown even to them. They didn't know that the essential message of Bhagavad Gita is bhakti, it's love. So, on the sacred day of Gita Jayanti, we offer our gratitude to Srila Prabhupada for translating and commenting on the Bhagavad Gita, for living the Bhagavad Gita and for bringing the Bhagavad Gita into our own lives. And let us pray to the Bhagavad Gita that this wisdom be realized in our hearts and that we can share it with as many souls as possible during our brief lifetime. Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Shri Krishna Bhagavan ki, Itai Gaur Premanande. Aye.